For those of you listening in, I will explain that in a moment. But kia ora and welcome to this Weber Training teleclass lecture. My name is Jane Barnett, and it gives me huge pleasure to introduce this South Pacific teleclass lecture, which is being broadcast live from the 31st annual conference of the recently renamed Infection Prevention and Control Nurses College, which is being hosted here in Palmerston North, New Zealand. Thank you very much to the organising committee for including a Weber lecture in this programme. Weber Training was established by Paul Weber in Canada over 10 years ago now, with the aim of making high-quality infection prevention and control education accessible across the globe. And I really think Paul has managed to achieve this. He's now become, or at least Weber Training, has become a household name in the field. And, for instance, the posters that you've been given in your conference handouts are one example of resources developed by Paul. So I'd like to acknowledge his huge support, not only here in New Zealand, but globally. I know that Paul is listening in to this lecture, so he'll appreciate that. Weber Training is reliant on the support of companies because we're entirely run by volunteers. So I'd like to acknowledge the support once again by Johnson & Johnson Medical, who sponsored this lecture. The theme of this conference is Intrepid Journeys, which has caused us a lot of fun. And it's very appropriate for our speaker, Dr. Kath Murphy, today, who's actually just returned from a trip to China, but is originally from Australia. It's also very appropriate for her rugby team, who are coming over to us again this week. We'll wait and see. Okay. Kath Murphy is well known to many of us in the field of infection prevention, as she's published and presented to a wide audience during her 25 years in the field. I was just saying to Kath, actually, that I too have reached my silver anniversary in infection prevention, which is a scary moment for us. But I don't know what I've been doing all these years. When I look at Kath's bio, I'm well behind. She's Australia's first infection prevention professional and to achieve a doctorate in the specialty, and has been a long-term advocate for improving practice. Her impressive credentials include roles as President of the State and National Associations in Australia, membership of Asian Pacific Society of Infection Control and WHO Expert Advisory Group, and more recently became the only non-North American elected to serve as President to APEC. She's now a senior partner in Infection Control Plus and contributes to the global stage in an educational capacity as invited speaker. We're delighted you're willing to cross the ditch to contribute to our conference, Kath, and thank you very much for talking to us today on the topic of From Little Things, Big Things Grow, the importance of leadership skills in infection prevention. Please join me in saying welcoming Kath.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And good evening, Paul, and thank you for this opportunity to again work with Weber. And to the sponsors, all sponsors that work with Weber, congratulations. Now, I am fortunate to be presenting today at the conference, but I would like to disclaim that I'm not being paid by any industry today. So, again, I have the luxury of presenting as Kath Murphy and can do so freely. So I'm grateful for J&J's support of this event, but I am independently here as an invited guest of the association. So we have lots to do this afternoon, and specifically these five objectives. What I will be doing is briefly reviewing the evolution of the infection practitioner's role. I will be reviewing the concept of leadership and how it fits into our work as ICPs. In doing that, I want to highlight some of the essential skills that I feel we should have, whether our leadership journey is at a local level or whether we go on to have some preeminence nationally or within one of the islands in a country like this, or even if you're fortunate enough to work on a more global level. And there are many leadership opportunities that are out there for us, so I hope by the end of it, anyone who's listening to this can identify those opportunities and also grab them wholeheartedly, knowing that you are well prepared, well skilled, and appropriately in the position to take advantage of those opportunities. In doing this, not just because I have an ego that's longer than my bio, but I think that if I can share with you some, I hope they're humble, my lifelong experiences or my journeys in leadership. And I often say to people that two things, and you won't know these, you'll never see them in writing, but I'll tell you about them. And the first one is that I grew up as a child in the suburbs of the south of Sydney in Sylvania, which has some importance in Australia. It's known as part of God's own territory. And never in my wildest dream did I ever think that anything I would be involved in would take me to the parts of the world that it has. So I would say to you, dream big, and sometimes things like that can happen. The second thing that I would say is that this remarkable journey that infection prevention has taken me upon is not one that's within my control. And I often say that the balloon will burst at some stage. Maybe I can burst that balloon when I'm ready to do so, or maybe it'll be burst for me. But I tell you what, while it's going, I'm going to enjoy this ride, and I hope that I get at least another 10 years out of it. So it's been a great ride and a fabulous opportunity to work, and a privilege to work with many of the people who are the real global experts in infection prevention. So I put this slide up here. Some of you may recognise these people because they're the mothers and fathers of infection prevention. So I'll take just a minute to point out a few of them. Bill Rotala, world expert in disinfection sterilisation. His co-partner was Marty Fivero, another world leader in infection prevention and control. Standing to Marty's left is Elaine Larson, without whom we probably would have never known about hand hygiene and its importance. I'm sure at some stage she was related to Semmelweis. If not, she should have been. Down in the front, to my right in that image, is Barb Sewell, who has done so much work internationally over her entire career. She's now somewhat aged and still working tirelessly with the Joint Commission International. Behind Sue Resnick, we have Carla Alvarado, who's done amazing work around human factors. And behind Carla is Teresa Horan, who is now retired, lucky Teresa, but well known for her work in establishing NIST, which has now gone on and become part of CDC's National Safety and Quality Group. To the right of Sue Resnick, we have Gina Puglisi, who I know was present down here in New Zealand, and Gina did so much of the early work around needle stick injury and sharps safety prevention. And then to Gina's right behind her is a very dear friend of mine and no relation, but Denise Murphy. Denise, without argument, leads the world's efforts around patient safety and particularly infection prevention. She's now a senior healthcare executive and has been probably one of my strongest mentors, although each of those people have mentored me to a different extent. Now, down here in the lower right is someone that I'm sure that you'll all know the name of, but you may not be able to recognise her image because she really was a mother of infection prevention. Does anybody know who it is? It's Julia Garner who wrote the first CDC guidelines for isolation, and she did that many, many years ago. And then if you come forward and over to the left of the slide, you'll see that there's actually been a couple of Aussies that have made a big impression on me, and one that I just happened to have a photo of was Glenys Harrington, who's a very loved and respected peer of mine, and then other people from CDC. So the one thing that I love about this slide is not that we all get together and have our pictures taken, but look how widely we're smiling. And that's good for a bunch of leaders to be fun, to have fun and to be enjoying their job. So never forget to have a bit of a smile on your face as you're doing your leadership. So let's look quickly at how all of this came together and how some of those people slotted into the field at particular times and then were able to become leaders. If you go back and think about our early role, and we had some curious discussion about it yesterday, we really have a lot to thank Staff Aureus for. It's now not our friend, but in the early days it was. And without the staff outbreaks of the early 1960s, none of us would be here, probably working in the ways that we are. Because at that time, we really needed to understand much more about asepsis. We had to understand a little bit about outbreaks, and we had to have some formal mechanisms for overseeing cleanliness in hospitals. And so whilst it's often debated between the UK and the US who had the first infection control sister or infection control practitioner, I believe it was the United Kingdom who in 1958 appointed the infection control officer. Now take note of that term officer. It has very much a policing context, and I'm glad that we've moved away from that, because as leaders I don't necessarily subscribe to the fact that we should ever be punitive. I think that you catch more bees with honey than with anything else, and I'll show you later about the importance of warmth and humour in leadership and how valuable they are as skill sets or personal attributes that you can have. But the US were fast to follow in the UK's lead, and they appointed their first infection control practitioner around 1963, and that was as a response to accreditation criteria. If ever you have a chance to go back and look at our history, this is a very compelling compelling paper that was published in The Lancet in 1962, which was a great year. And this paper was called The Infection Control Sister, a new member of the control of the infection team in general hospitals. And so, again, we've moved from that term infection control sister, and, again, I think that's probably a good thing. But what I really like about this paper is when you look at the summary and conclusion, and looking at the duties of the infection control sister, just have a quick look. I'll take one of my favourite phrases in here, and that is that the infection control sister does play an important role, so that's not changed at all, needs to maintain records upon which all assessment and decisions regarding infection control are based. And again, that's not changed in many years. What it says, there are moments when utmost patience and tact are called for, and the necessity for exerting these qualities cannot be exaggerated. Now, I find that hysterical because I've never been known for my tact, and I don't think I'm going to develop it at this age, but clearly it was something that was needed in the early days, and I'm very grateful that people were more tactful than perhaps we are. But the question of what is the role, what is the function of the infection control professional, and subsequently how can you lead within that profession, I think still remains unanswered. In the mid-90s, I spent several years doing my PhD work around that for Australian ICPs, and I know from yesterday's questions it's still unclear. The UK have done a remarkable job at trying to formalise that for us, and they, back in 2005, put forward this model of the functions of the infection control nurse, and much of the things that are listed on this slide are really functions and roles that we still perform to some extent. And there are things like controlling of outbreaks, being involved in annual program planning and such like. I think this probably sells us short now in terms of what is really and truly required of us, because we're under much more pressure to be more strategic, to be more businesslike in the way that we perform our work, and our roles becoming much more diversified as we mesh and mould more with safety and quality, and also, I think, as we become more accountable. So I'm most intimately familiar with how Australian infection prevention developed, and this is a long list of the events or the milestones that have helped to shape us. I won't read them all, but I'll just pick out a couple of themes. The first one was that we were driven by following a trend, an international trend, which is often what drives Australia and I think other places here in the region. And we're lucky, and we talked at lunchtime with some people about how we can take opportunities and with a retrospectoscope take and look at how other parts of the world have performed, and we can take the very best of them and then really domesticate them so that they work well for our setting. And I think New Zealand has that luxury as well. In fact, you probably take much of what we've ruined and make it even better. So in some ways you probably have ultimately the best models of lots of things. We had a very strong professional association, and wherever I've been in the world, I have always found professional associations to be critical. They really underpin a lot of opportunity, and they provide great platforms for learning leadership skills. And I don't think it's not by chance that I've had the opportunities to lead because of any personal education. My opportunities to lead have been through positions, voluntary positions on those professional bodies, because they've given me exposure to other experts, and I've learnt and watched how they carry themselves, the way that they work. I've looked for people who are good mentors, and to me, there's no better grounding for us than professional associations and government committees and the like. Some of the other things that have really required us to be leaders in infection prevention in Australia have been clinical nightmares and our infamous patient-to-patient transmission of HIV back in the late 1980s was probably the worst one. But it provided a great leadership opportunity because we had to step up to the plate and start working with government to educate, to help write guidelines, to help write policy and ultimately legislation. And we've got other drivers that we've had to respond to and contribute to, and they've been more recently the work of our Australian Safety and Quality Commission in healthcare and the assisting with the drafting of their standards. So there are lots of opportunities similar to here. So experts have moved towards competency models, and some of the competencies that are now considered critical for infection prevention leaders are around developing programs that have strategic goals, and that those strategic goals are in alignment with the organisational goals. So yesterday we saw a presentation that talked in the mission of the hospital and the vision of the hospital and the intent of the hospital and how Miriam so eloquently built in her infection prevention program to align with those with that mission and those goals. So that's what we all need to be doing. We also need to constantly be balancing our workload around those priorities which are patient-focused, because we're in the business of caring for patients and making their patient journey safer and patient-centric. But we have to do that by also responding to an ever-changing landscape in terms of regulatory and accreditation requirements. So we have to be nimble and we have to be fast to action, and that's not always an easy thing to do. The economic environment impacts the way that we do our work. And it does it in lots of ways by changing staffing ratios, by putting people under pressure, by making us have limited choices perhaps in the technologies or the devices or equipment that are made available to us. So leaders appreciate that and they respond to it and become probably more innovative in the ways that they address it. So being strategic is a really important quality in an infection prevention leader. If you'd like to know more about a more recent competency model, I'll refer you to this APIC competency model. APIC spent many years working on this, recent years, and under Denise Murphy's leadership as chair of a subcommittee, they actually defined four key domains, which were for the ICP, which were leadership, program management, performance improvement, and implementation science, infection prevention and control, and also a technical domain. So I'll just mention it, but refer you to it, and hopefully you've got an opportunity to look at it. I've spoken a little of some of the factors that impact our role, but really there are others, and they are critically our role as leaders in outbreaks, both in detecting outbreaks, so understanding all the microbiological things that Jim spoke to us about this morning, but in an outbreak, being brave enough to stand up and to show leadership. And that leadership may mean you need to be quiet at times and reflect and listen, or it may mean that you need to actually take the bull by the horns and truly lead. And of the things that I've done clinically, one of the ways that I'm forever grateful that I got involved in it was my own work with the World Health Organization in 2003 when I went off to work throughout Southeast Asia at the height of the SARS outbreak. Now, people asked me why would I have done that when my normal day job at that time was to sit in an office with a view of Sydney Harbour and write policy and push a pen. And I hadn't been in a clinical setting for some probably 7 years by that point. And there was two things that drove me, and the second was more important than the first. The first was that I was a little bit bored in that office and I thought it would be good to get out there and catch up with all my friends from overseas and really see what was happening in Southeast Asia. And that was an immature motivator. But the more compelling motivator for me was that This was a time of extreme scare and fear globally about infection prevention. And I was in the business of writing policy and telling people what to do and what to wear it and how to dispose of it and how to purchase it and how to evaluate it. And I knew that as a leader it was important that I was prepared to go out there and show them that what I told them to do actually worked. And so off I went, foolishly, and hopefully did that and demonstrated that it was okay, that if you did the right things that you could survive. Now, it was a great opportunity to really walk the walk, and I look back on that time with many mixed emotions, but I tell you what, it was probably one of the most exciting leadership opportunities that I've ever had, and I will be forever grateful for that opportunity. We have other things that are impacting our role now, and I spoke yesterday at great length about this whole interaction and the need for us to better understand the public's perception of our role and public expectation around infections and safety when they go into hospitals. There are other more academic things that we need to do as leaders, and that includes, unfortunately for some of you that don't like confidence intervals or statistics or p-values, it does take an understanding of research, because as leaders we need to be able to not necessarily do the research but certainly understand it and make our decisions based on that evidence, and to implement the science and to take findings to the bedside and make a positive impact upon patients. And of course we need to be innovators, and some of us will be more towards one end of that innovation curve than the other, but it's a critical thing that we can do. So when I talk about leadership, I've talked about it so far in the context of the infection prevention and control world. But we've also had a couple of speakers today and yesterday who've talked to us about the importance of looking outside of our own domains and our own infection control worlds and look and see what leadership and other qualities are in those worlds. So to me, leadership is much more than just convincing people to follow rules. It's about having skills qualities and practicing communication. Clearly communicating, getting messages across, understanding that they've been received and interpreted and acted upon appropriately. It's about being a team player, so working in a highly functioning team where everybody feels valued and able to contribute. It always requires collaboration. And so events like this are great, as are team collaborations at a more local level. Good leaders are also able to think in the current time, look back to the past, reflect, as we often do, but more importantly, to look forward and try and be a little bit predictive. So I know yesterday I tried to stimulate you by telling you how I saw part of the future perhaps unfolding, and I hope that many of you may have had some seeds planted where you can think about New Zealand's future and where this country may be going, and for those of you listening in other parts of the world, what will happen in your own domestic sphere. A good leader has people buy in, so they have those marketing skills, that ability to influence, to have people at least become curious, if not subscribe at the point. And you also, at a local level, need to fully appreciate, adopt and support your organisation's philosophy and be able to communicate the expectations of your organisation and be able to, importantly, develop the next generation of leaders. And again, I know yesterday we spoke about that, and I was introduced to the concept of us having a very dry pipeline in infection control, and that pipeline is dry all around the world. So if those of us that are celebrating silver anniversaries, or I actually call it my grey anniversary because there's much more of grey than anything else on the top of my head, but those of us that have been around for a while, the best thing that we can do now is to invest in the next leaders and see that they are well positioned to carry forward. So that's why I'm excited when I see young faces here, even if they're young in terms of infection control years, we need to be investing in them. So leadership in healthcare is a very rewarding environment, and it is one in which a key role can be resolving conflict. Because healthcare is a difficult environment. It's unlike other portfolio areas. So It's been shown that if a workplace is satisfied with their leader, that they will have these attributes. A good leader in healthcare can motivate and can inspire staff so that there will be less turnover and better patient care. So let's really look now at what leadership is like outside of healthcare. And I put this image up because it's a cracker image. Those of you that don't know, I'm a part-time photographer and I love this. And to me, it really did require looking at the world through a different lens and a different perspective. And I'll let you think about how that image was captured. But I use it to illustrate our need to look differently at infection prevention. So I often look to Harvard Business Review and I read about leadership in business to see what I can learn from it. And I was very lucky because in 2013 there's been quite a few articles which are cited on the bottom here in the reference about leadership. So this particular article described strategic leadership and listed these six skills that a leader needed to be able to use simultaneously to think strategically and to navigate unknown waters in an effective way. And if there are any waters that I think that are unknown in healthcare, I'd suggest that infection prevention are one of the biggest unknowns. So in an infection preventionist's toolbox, these are the types of things that they should be able to do. They should be able to make decisions. They should be open to learning. And that learning, surprisingly, has to be lifelong. We need to be able to align our goals and our program goals with the organisation and with governments and mandates that come from them. We should be up for challenges, and we should be able to challenge people when they're not doing the right thing. And then, obviously, we need to have skills of interpretation and anticipation as well. So if we look at these in more detail, and let's just look at one of them. So if we think about anticipation, one of the recommendations for someone who's involved in anticipating is that they gather information from a wide network of experts and sources that are both inside and outside of our industry or function, because it helps us see how other individuals and other streams of life and work have addressed problems. So that's why I think it's great when we read quality papers where they look to the airline industry, where they look to mining, where we look to good process and good manufacture. That's why yesterday I spent quite a bit of time talking about our need to look at industry, our medical industry partners who can teach us about changing behaviours, influencing, applying knowledge, applying methods to find out about research and development. So go outside of healthcare and see what you can learn from other industries. Sit in a coffee shop and watch how they serve their customers. Sit in a restaurant and watch how they serve their customers. There are subtle lessons for us everywhere. How they put messages out there. Look at the airport. I'm always amazed when I travel at how the one place in the world that I can see people do exactly as they're told to is when they're trying to immigrate. Nobody deviates out of that line. Everybody fills in their form perfectly. They get their passport out, their boarding pass. They put their things through security. If only we could have such compliance around hand hygiene or line insertion. So what is it that motivates people? Start thinking curiously and look for the subtle things that do it. Is it the fear of a fine, or is it the joy of what's on the other side? Maybe a little bit of both. Maybe it's just the excitement of travel. Anyway, that's just some odd examples for me to use. Now, this is a curious question. Is it better as a leader to be loved or feared? Hands up in this room, who thinks it's better to be loved? It's always nice to be loved. Who thinks it's better to be feared? Oh, we've got one brave one. No, there can be fearful people that are very lovely. That's a great, great point. What we know is today that most people, leaders, will emphasise strength, competence and their credentials in the workplace, and they'll do that to validate their position. And I've shamelessly done that from the podium today, so I apologise to it. But I can do that because I know that in a little way I am loved in New Zealand, and I'm very grateful for that. And, of course, I love you guys as well, and your wine and your chocolate. But not your weather and nor your rugby. But there's been some interesting research done around leaders who project their strength before they actually establish a position of trust within teams. And what that can lead to is dysfunction amongst teams. So it's good to understand this a little bit. And what the current thinking is now is that it's actually better to begin from a position of warmth. So to be open, to be honest, to do all of these things, because with warmth you can get better influence. Maybe that's why pastors and reverends and religious icons have always been good leaders and charismatic, because they've come from positions of warmth. And if you look at this little model, you will see that, it's going to be hard for me to do this without seeing, but if you look up this axis, which is the y-axis, you'll see warmth. Down the bottom is low warmth and up the top is high warmth. Look now along the bottom axis, the x-axis, and you'll see that's competence. So if someone has low warmth and low competence, they'll actually create a position where they're held in contempt, which is not a good place for a leader to be. Whereas if somebody has both high warmth and high competence, they become a very admired leader. So it's good to be loved, but you also have to have a degree of fear. So I'd say that any of you that answered my question are actually correct. And note here that if you have high competence but low warmth, you'll be in a position of envy. And if you have the opposite, which is high warmth but low competence, your team or the people you're trying to lead will just pity you. So I think we need to try and stay away from both pity and envy, neither of which are particularly important. Now, just a few weeks ago at the APIC convention in Florida, there was a fabulous keynote. And what they did was APIC, celebrating 40 years, gathered 12 of the most influential leaders over those four decades. And they had them each recall what had been the key highlights of their life. Sitting here, we have Dick Wenzel, Elaine Larson, and Carla Alvarado. And they were really three of the experts that were representing, I think, the 80s. They'd kill me if I said the 70s. But they talked about how they gained influence, and it was quite similar to what had been published in the Harvard Business Review. And they said that there were four competencies that leaders demonstrated, which are different to the four competencies that APIC put up as the competency model. But they said that competent leaders these days were trailblazers, so people who are willing to go out and to test things. And I've always thought about, you know, only the path beaters meet the lions. So being a trailblazer takes courage, but it can also be incredibly rewarding as you discover things that have not been discovered before. They are tool makers, they are team workers, and they are prepared to translate messages and learnings from outside of their field into their own, and even messages within their own field to make them clearer. So here's how Harvard Business Review describes them. Trailblazing is where you find new opportunities to use your expertise. Toolmaking, where you deploy and develop tools that help spread expertise. So those tools could be mentorship tools, systems of mentorship. They could be tools that help you learn, audit tools, things like the World Hand Hygiene tools that have been so graciously developed and made available to all of us around the world. They are great team workers, using their ability to interact with people at a personal level to convince them of your relevant position and to let them know that you're listening to their perspective as well. And then they become masters at translating, so taking complex concepts, complex discussions, complex arguments, and making them easier to be understood. I now will play the view of an expert, a true expert, for you.
What is the one thing that I would say, look for or say to someone about their role as a leader in infection prevention? I think being authentic. I think being authentic is the most important thing in developing relationships, and relationship management is really the most important thing in being able to influence people to be protectors of patients and communities. So I can't say that anything's more important than being authentic. And that takes into account knowing who you are and being honest with others about what you bring to the table and making your values very clear to everyone. Here's what I stand for, and here's where I won't compromise away from my values. So when I say authentic, it's one word, but those are, I think, the key attributes of being authentic is honesty, integrity, and being able to know where you will and won't compromise.
That was Denise Murphy, and I'm grateful to her always for her leadership and mentorship and for letting me interview her. And the bit that you didn't hear was the one question where I said to her, what's the one thing you would tell an aspiring leader? And I found that a valuable piece to carry on. And there are two more films I hope I get the chance to share with you. We'll see how time permits. There's been recent work by Sanjay Sent, a doc from... he's up in Michigan at Ann Arbor. And Sanjay published this great paper talking about what leadership is in terms of healthcare-associated infection. So I'd commend this paper to you. Please have a look at it if you get a chance, and I can point you to it. He, in summary, says that these are the things to do: create a culture of clinical excellence and communicate it to staff. So all the things that we've heard today about providing feedback, providing advice, focus on overcoming those barriers that stop us from translating research back to the bedside. Be inspiring, and think strategically while acting locally. And that's a lot harder to do than it is to say. We need to become masters at politicking, and we need to be able to leverage our own personal positions of prestige, which is difficult when you have those power differentials in the clinical setting, where traditionally nurses and doctors are not on the same gradient. But we can form partnerships across disciplines that work. We'll look now at leadership from traditional business. Again, this is from the Australian Financial Review, where leadership's probably a bit different from an Aussie's perspective, but they say that leaders are those who stand out, who have the ability to affect change, who have durability, and I would say sustainability as well, depth of experience, and an ability to connect with a broader community. So again, that sense of moving beyond our infection prevention community. Harvard Business Review back in 2010 talked about healthcare specifically and our requirements to have doctors now be much more reviewed by leadership on their performance rather than just their clinical performance, but to know how their patients come out, what incentives are around their work, and also to have better processes and to not be part of dysfunctional teams. So let's look now at Russ Olmsted, who was the APIC president the year after me, and what he says is the one thing about being an excellent ICP leader, and let's hope it works.
If you had one piece of advice that you could give to an aspiring infection prevention leader about how they can prepare themselves for a leadership role within their own organisation, what would that piece of advice be?
Yeah, great question. I think probably, to me, the influence that we have on our colleagues, no matter where the healthcare setting is, generally derive, especially from the science. So if you've got scientific evidence behind you, I think you can really accomplish a lot. It won't be absolutely everything, but I think that when we talk about our colleagues, they really are focused on evidence, you know, what is going to be effective to make my patient better, improve the quality of care. So the one thing I would say, become a critical consumer of the scientific evidence. That doesn't mean you have to be a researcher and, you know, go into multi-center randomized control trials, but if you understand the methodology, the quality of the studies, and the information that's coming out of that, I think you're going to gain a lot in influential leadership. And one thing that we're looking at very seriously is not only the concept of followership is a key piece of leadership. So we all think of leaders as, you know, we're developing new leaders. Actually, leadership is more of a process than just a focus on one key individual who's got, you know, some good talents and skills. Instead, I think followership probably is as important so that we have a broad base of folks that are really supporting a project.
Do you want to try and define followership?
Yeah, great question. It's a difficult concept. I think there's actually some good reviews, not so much in the scientific literature, but more of the health policy literature that talks about really the key to developing good leaders is that individual has to have followers. And one example I can share personally was you probably heard about a project preventing central line associated bloodstream infections. Interestingly, that really grew up totally outside of the arena of infection preventionists. It was really intensivists, organizational leadership, and then nursing leadership in the intensive care units. And I think that was to its benefit because it really drove the change. And then suddenly, in the midst of the project, they realized, hey, we need data to see if are we making a difference. That's when the IP got involved and started talking about here's the data that we're collecting for the facility. And I think that teamwork membership really was more of a followership piece as opposed to a leadership of that project, and it has been very successful.
Thanks, Russ. Great job. I feel like Oprah when I ask them those questions. If only I had her money. So how do these infection prevention leaders see leadership in summary? These are the things that I gleaned from their presentations. Denise spoke about having passion, and that underpins everything we do, about having goals, about working together, about knowing our uniqueness was what Denise Icardo would have told you if we were able to listen to her her video, which unfortunately didn't work. She also said know about the uniqueness and capitalise on that and the uniqueness and skills of others, which is really important. Being authentic and maintaining integrity is critical. And I'll follow that through tomorrow in the presentation about working with industry, and I think ethical parts of infection prevention are very interesting. Being gracious and acting with humility is a very important thing for us to do, I think, in life generally, but certainly in our infection prevention life, and some do it far better than others. The other thing that I really do think is important is for a leader to be able to step back, to know when you've had your time, and to graciously exit, but timing that's not always easy. Russ spoke about followers, so in the interest of time, I'm going to just go on to the next step, which is the opportunities to lead. Now, this good-looking young woman, before she was APIC president and aged considerably, is here sitting next to the director of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and Dick Wenzel. And again, I sat and looked to my left and right and thought, what am I doing here? I'm so far out of my league. It was at the fourth decennial in 2010. But what a great opportunity to lead that I would never have had without putting myself out there. So I then thought, you know, why don't I share my 10 secret tips to leadership with you? And I know that there's only a few of you that will know about this, those that are listening and the 100 or so here in the room. So here are the 10 things that I think you can do better. Sarah, I dedicate these to you. First of all, find a mentor or be a mentor. Both are important and both are very valuable. Second, be a good role model, and you need to do that locally and beyond. So wherever your infection prevention journey goes, remember that you are a role model. And that doesn't mean just in washing your hands. It means in the way that you conduct yourself and the way that you represent our field, which is your honour and your privilege. The second thing is become very active in opportunities around public policy. So we heard today about the great work and the representation on the C. diff committee, the CLABSI committee that you guys have got going. We had this opportunity with our Australian Safety and Quality Committee. Rather than complaining and whinging and whining about public policy, get in there and start to influence it, because you'll get a seat at the table. The other thing is stay strong and always fight for what's right. And you'll see here Barb Sewell, Gina Puglisi and Denise Murphy just keeping their guns in good strength. And this was in good humour, but they would kill me if they knew how I'd used it. The other thing I'd say to you is always be willing to go the extra mile. And as intrepid travellers, wow, do you go the extra mile or what? And I can't wait for our journey tonight. I'm going to go the extra glass as well as the extra mile. This is a WHO meeting in Geneva, 2008, and you can see from all around the world are people committed to infection prevention. Many of them you may know, Julie Storr, Sharon Salmon, Wing Hong Sito, others who are leaders in infection prevention who've got literally and figuratively gone the extra mile. In a similar vein, expand your networks. So New Zealand's a beautiful country. Your counties, your DHBs are very important, but expand your networks. Go across the ditch and learn how to play rugby, learn how to play infection prevention. I'll never stop those types of comments. And this was back in 1998 where a young bunch of us got together to form APSIC. This was the founding meeting, so there were many of us from many countries. The other thing that I think has been really important for me has been about learning about my peers, not just what they do, but who they are, what their work is and what their programs are, but really what they stand for as people and their experiences. And by listening more than speaking, you can often understand and learn a lot. The other thing is that we should respect the past, and here are two of the greats of the past. One of these guys' names I heard mentioned yesterday. Some of you might know the name if you were to read it, but you may not recognise the picture. And I'll tell you who it is. It's Bob Haley, father of Scenic, on the right, and on the left is Dennis Mackey, father of intravenous excellence. So I respect both Mackey and Haley. I've had a drink with both of them, a couple, in fact. But I don't dwell on what they've done. No pun intended for the IV stuff. But, you know, they've made great contributions and others have developed their work. So I always look to the past and respect it. Now, this one is really important. I think we should always look out for the next generation of ICPs. And the story behind this cute slide is that this was my co-worker's son who popped in to see his dad one day in the office when our boss was away. And so we popped the kid in the boss's seat and took the photo and sent it to our boss and told her that we'd replaced her as the boss. And so she said he's welcome to it. But anyway, we nicknamed him the CEO and he's now 7 and quite close to getting a real job in infection prevention. But we always look out for the next generation, as we should. Something that we're getting better at doing, and I think this is also critical, is exploring and embracing new technologies and new applications. Not necessarily just clinical things, but social media is a great version. And to have a Facebook page is not, you know, it's yesterday actually. This is my company's Facebook page. I'd love you guys to help me get over 100. I think we're sitting at about 97. So please could three of you just go and like it tonight. Go find it. I promise I'll put up some secret message, the 11th tip. Other technologies, Pinterest. So some images that we've got up there that, you know, things that we like that we share. And other technology down the bottom is a project that I'm currently working on, which is an interface, web-based interface, where I'm mentoring a team of 10 from Singapore National University Hospital, and we're working as a team virtually across the internet over a six-month period, and it builds upon some other work that I've done, but that is very exciting to me to be able to mentor across the work. The other thing to do is tell others about your work. Don't be ashamed about it. Be proud about it. Publish, and publish often. Speak when you have the opportunity. Put your abstracts in and make sure that others hear about it. Because our leadership is lifelong and our challenge to be leaders is lifelong. I think we do that by being role models, by holding ourselves accountable, by being integrous and striving for excellence in what we do. And if we do that, then we will inspire others to follow some of our pathways and to use some of the things that we teach them as they beat their own path down. As a mentor and a leader, we are able to demonstrate a very deep understanding of strengths and needs of others as well as ourselves. And we are innovators. We are people of great resource, of resonance. We're reasonable and we're well planned in what we execute. Above everything else, infection preventionists must be able to demonstrate a passion for infection prevention. And I'm incredibly passionate about it, grateful and passionate. As a result of that, I think enthusiasm that we display internally and externally helps to inspire others and help them have a desire to implement those measures that will help us get to perfect patient care. and we should never accept or be part of anything that's less than perfect patient care. So some recent work that has been of interest to me is another book. I recommend it both to men and to women. This is the work of Sheryl Sandberg, the Chief Operating Officer of Facebook, where she's written this book called Lean In. It's titled Women, Work and the Will to Lead. Now, I got a few things out of this book. The first thing was she talks about, are you sitting at a table? And not just as women, but as infection preventionists, we need to be sitting at as many tables as we can, to be up there having discussions, to legitimately believe that we have a right to be involved in those discussions and making decisions. We need to think about success and likability, and I showed you about warmth and compassion, so you'll understand that. The other thing we need to be able to do is we need to speak truthfully. And sometimes it's painful for others to hear, but sometimes we need to do it. But we also need to be humble enough to go in search of the truth and to seek it out. And probably it's better to seek it out rather before we speak it. This other one's particularly important and somewhat contradictory to what I said to you as one of my secret 10 tips. I said, be humble enough to know when you should leave. But the flip side of that is, don't leave before you leave. So even if you're ready to retire or get out of infection control, you have to stay active until you physically, emotionally, contractually leave the field. So don't burn out, wear out. Get out before that happens. Okay, so don't be a half-hearted ICP. Be in there. So I'll conclude with a lovely word bubble that has grabbed together many of the words that I put them through the some fabulous computer program, the video text, and this is what it showed me were the things that are important in infection prevention leaders: passion, courage, honesty, uniqueness, priorities, simplicity, inspiration, confidence, engagement, value. They're all there. I hope that this has been a valuable presentation to many of you. I hope that it's been able to resonate with you. It's been a joy for me to think about this, to have the luxury of pulling it together, to truly have an opportunity to share it. And please go forward, be strong leaders, as I know you already are. And I wish you the best in that leadership journey.
Thank you very much, Kath. I'd like to open up to the audience here in Palmerston North for questions. If you would like to ask Kath a question, then just indicate and we'll get the microphone to you. Just before we do that, I'd like to ask how many people in the audience would actually class themselves as a new practitioner in the field of infection prevention? Okay. So how many hands do you reckon that is? About a dozen? So how many of you have actually had someone that you would have or has been called a designated mentor in this role? I can see a couple of hands. So it's something that we really need to work on and get right. Are there any questions for Kath?
Hi, Sarah Harris from Hutt Valley DHB. Funnily enough, we were having a lot of discussions yesterday about mentorship and how we capture new people coming in with some of the people from the committee. And given that our next conference isn't for 2 years, if somebody comes into the specialty tomorrow, do you have any advice on how we can capture them and drag them in, but also identify mentors without shoving them on them, because obviously you've got to find that right fit as well. Have you got any advice?
Sure, and mentorship has been the one thing that I have never been without every year, and I still have a number of mentors, formally and informally. So I don't think I'll ever be without a mentor, and I will always need one. So if I were coming into an association now, and I know that APIC have done this because we started doing it under my leadership, and I'd recommend a similar model to other countries, is find within your field those people who feel that they have the ability to be leaders and to be mentors, who are willing to undertake that journey, and then offer that to new members. And you may need to call for expressions of interest or something along those lines. There are many tools that are available that can help form an initial mentorship relationship. And, you know, one of the important things about mentorship is that it can be both organic, but it's also good to have some formal structures in place for a formal mentorship, which includes goals and boundaries that can't be broken. And I have observed in my own mentorship roles, and particularly as I've matured professionally, because I'm still very childlike, as I've matured, I've found that the role between mentor and mentee can change. And sometimes, even with my mentors, I'll be mentoring them, and they'll be the mentee, and that's probably just maturity. But it's a very honoured position to be in.
Natasha from Christchurch, this is very embarrassing, but along with mentorship, I'd also suggest that professional supervision is also relatively new for nursing, but not so much in mental health, but also other professions have used professional supervision. I'd also make a suggestion that it also goes hand in hand with mentorship, because mentorship's relevant within the immediate environment and your practical day-to-day, but it's also important to have that backup professional supervision outside of that environment.
Sure, supervision's absolutely important. And having a trusted place that you can go to when you're perhaps not so sure of whether you're making the right decision. And even having your opinions validated or questioned is good. And Jane and I were talking about how many ICPs work in isolation, no pun intended. You know, we often work alone, and it can become a dark and scary place when you don't have somewhere to go to. So things like cross-cultural exchanges are really important, and traditionally they've involved, I know, some models where there's been visiting to international hospitals, but now with many of the technologies that are available, they don't physically have to involve such great distances, although that's always fun. Nothing better than going in and having a look at how someone else's program runs. And that, even if it's just the hospital up the road or, you know, in another island. And for the first 15 years of my life, and this is a really sad confession, every time I went on holidays, if there was a hospital, I would go and find out who the ICP was and get them to show me their program. Because I picked up a lot of things that way, and some of you, I think, have probably hosted me at yours. Down in Dunedin, I did not go to the hospital, but I went to the Cadbury factory, so another weakness.
I think at that point we'll close. Those of us here, I know, will make the most of the opportunity to talk to Cass informally over those remaining tea and lunch breaks. So thank you very much for those questions from the floor. So at this point, I'd like to close today's session. Thanks again to Kath Murphy. I think wherever we are in our professional lives, you've actually given us all food for thought, which is fantastic. I'd also like to thank again Johnson & Johnson Medical for their support for today's Weber Training Lecture, and of course the technical team at the back, Mike and Luke, for their support in setting it up here. I hope you found today's lecture as stimulating as we have here. The next South Pacific Weber Training Lecture will take place in October, and will feature another Australian colleague, Elizabeth MacDonald from Darwin. So until then, goodbye from us all here in Palmerston North. Thank you.